You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Cameron Polavlada.
And I'm Mac Arisimovic.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 34 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate. If you read War and Peace, you might be thinking a lot about the war elements and the peace elements at different discrete times. Well, Grossman's here to tell you they're the same thing. Ahead of the Battle of Stalingrad, we have all of our characters sitting down for a nice meal. And especially Novikov and Neudobnov, having some interesting dichotomies, which maybe don't reflect their true internal life being reflected into the table. Is there anywhere here that you'd like to begin?
Yeah, there is this first scene that kind of, I think, kicks off the internal action of the plot. And, well, maybe it's not exactly the first scene, but there is a scene of Novikov basically walking by these new recruits who are kind of, they kind of look like they're falling apart. They're half asleep on the grass. They've clearly walked like in unimaginable amount of miles. They're just, their feet are blistered. And what strikes him is how young all of them are. And he is thinking to himself how nobody is ever really concerned about the number of lives that are lost. But instead, they're worried about following orders and they're worried about not looking a certain way, or rather looking, trying to be perceived a certain way by their superiors. And he is frustrated by this. And so when he goes to dinner, for whatever reason, his response to this is, I'm going to do the opposite, and I'm going to play the part of the big bad Soviet general, and I'm going to talk about how I like sacrificing my men, and we need more supplies. We don't need men. Anybody can make men, but what we need are more supplies. And Neudobnov is clearly a better political maneuver than Novikov, which might not be saying anything at all, because Novikov is clearly the worst in the room at this. And, you know, he just kind of pays lip service to the idea that, oh, well, no, Stalin said we do have to care about our men. And everyone says, yeah, we should do that. And it just kind of feels like this frustrating performative chapter, in the sense that everyone is playing the part of somebody that they're not. and nobody's able to really talk honestly or truthfully about what they are experiencing, it feels like.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's especially poignant in the, as you mentioned, they've got these young recruits who he sees fresh-faced, and not only does he think how young they are, how childlike they are, which is a theme we've hit often in Life and Fate, the youngness of many of these soldiers. He also thinks on how strange it is that, you know, we're allowed to do this, that we are given the right to order young boys like these to their deaths. And he says, that was the mystery and tragedy of war, that one man should have the right to send another to his death. This right rested on the assumption that men were only exposed to fire for the sake of a common cause. And as is explored in the surrounding paragraphs to that line, oftentimes the common cause is not for what reason that these men are being ordered out. It may often be simply as small as, I don't want my boss to be mad at me. Or, as is the case in A Man Who Follows, the man in the following chapter, an officer who would like fresh milk every morning. Although paradoxically, that officer he mentions is well-liked by his men. And I think that's an interesting fact, because he's throwing in these complicating factors of, well, it's not just good officers and bad officers. There's this strange world of even this relatively good officer can also be one throwing away his men senselessly. And it continues to be strange. But amid all of that, Neudobnov comes in as he's musing about how strange it is that I can order these young boys to die in combat. And Neudobnov comes in and says, can you believe those guys? Man, I was about to send them to a penal battalion.
Yeah, right.
Like, what slovenliness? I mean, what are they? You just marched 800 miles? Pick yourself up.
Yeah. Yeah. By your bootstraps.
Which, of course,
that no longer function. Right.
Literally don't exist anymore. They've been worn out by the road.
Disintegrated.
Right. And which makes the following scene, as you mentioned, at the dinner or whatever kind of party it is among these officers, more ironic as they adopt these opposite stances from what really reflects, seems to reflect their inner lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And then turning to our Discord today, our listener, Reagan, had a few comments that pretty much perfectly summarize how I was feeling on the Novikov of it all. And this one point, which was just pure brilliance. Reagan says, Novikov monologuing about military theory at an imaginary Zhenya gave Big Ken, I'll play my guitar at you energy. And I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. And yeah, that is kind of, I feel like Novikov could be like, I don't know, Red Army Ken in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I feel like if you want to draw that out, I mean, I've never seen Barbie, so I'm kind of assuming some events here, but you've got Stalingrad Novikov, who's this upright soldier played completely straight, who I imagine will be early movie Ken. And then you have Novikov of Life and Fate, who I imagine is whenever they get to the real world, which I think happens, you know, what happened. That's the Ken you get for the rest of this novel.
Yeah, it comes one Tame Impala song later. Famously Joseph Stalin's favorite band, so.
Yeah, they won't usually let you know that, but yeah. Really big. Mm-hmm. Really big in them, Simple Plan.
He did not like when she was holding hands with Trevor. No.
Yeah, and then, you know, I also want to go to another comment that Reagan made a little later, speaking about how Novikov has such this very interesting view of Zhenya, where she's always like there. Yes, of course he's going to marry her, and of course he's going to do all these other things. But also, when he imagines her walking to this very room instead of any sense of joy or whatever, he's intensely jealous that she's going to start liking this other guy who he hates more than him. And Reagan says, he's consistently imagining what Zhenya would think or feel in every situation, but never listens to her actual thoughts or feelings when she expresses them. See the whole thing where she's like, I will immediately leave you for Krivov if he gets hurt. I was definitely laughing at him trying to impress her when the reality is he has no idea what she finds impressive. I don't know what their relationship was like in Stalingrad, but in the Life and Fate scene between them, he didn't listen to a single word she said. I think we've touched on this a few ways. One of the interesting character evolutions through these two novels. First of all, Zhenya getting an actual internal life, and secondarily, Novikov being taken in a fairly different direction from how he was in Life in Stalingrad.
Yeah, he's infinitely more interesting here to me. Just not in like a good way, but just in the way that he is. I don't know. Zhenya seems to be this sort of just place for him to, you know, project this personal fantasy onto, and maybe it's helpful for him to sort of mentally make it through the war. I, you know, can't knock him necessarily for that, but you think that, as Reagan says, you would think that for somebody who spends so much time thinking about another person, that Novikov could, for just one second in the day, just perhaps listen to any of the words that come out of Zhenya's mouth, which he so aggressively spends most of the novel so far not doing.
Right, which, as you say, makes him a more interesting character, someone who's got such, by all accounts, a good commander, a good person, deeply caring of others, also deeply dismissive of people. I won't say theoretically loves, because I think he clearly does have deep care for her, but that does not necessarily include care for what she's saying, or I guess feels or believes, which, you know, I think it does make it more interesting that he's partially in love with his idea of her.
Yeah, and maybe
really,
that is
very explicit.
Maybe that's what makes him a good commander, because he doesn't need to actually listen to what people are saying, because he's not going to act on it. He sort of has this like laissez-faire, okay, sure, do what you need to do approach to tank corps movement.
Well, and maybe in the ways that Zhenya and Novikov, who both speak the same language and yet can't understand each other, we find much of the tragedy of the 21st century, 20th century.
Also the 21st century, too.
Also the 21st.
Many centuries.
Maybe every century.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a long 20th.
The long 20th. Which, of course, encompasses all of human history.
Yes, well, it really does. It will extend back, basically, to forever.
Yeah. You just need a bolder historian. It's like what's that scene from Oppenheimer where there's the one guy at when they're out in the desert and he's like, yeah, it's the biggest bomb. And the guy's like, until someone builds a bigger bomb. It's like that with that guy going like, until someone theorizes a longer century.
Yeah, right.
Every time. Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, we're getting everything else you want to cover in this chapter today.
No, I am good on this chapter. It was a chapter.
Yeah. All right. Well, in that case, you will hear from us again soon.